Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, the Middle East conflict wipes out mining cost relief and raises fresh industry alarm. South African workers are raiding their retirement savings as financial strain deepens. Surging energy costs could put home ownership even further beyond reach. And rising fuel prices are forcing a smarter, smaller rethink of the office model. It's Friday, the 10th of April. South Africa's mining sector is once again under pressure, with the Minerals Council warning that the Middle East conflict has reversed a brief period of cost relief, pushing up fuel prices, weakening the rand, and driving a fresh surge in input costs. The concern, I think, is that what looked like a temporary reprieve is turning quickly into a renewed inflation cycle for an industry that, as you well know, is already battling structural cost pressures. I want to talk now to Bongani Motsa, who's chief economist at the council. Bongani, a very warm welcome. How quickly has the situation turned, in your opinion? And that cost relief that I referred to, do you think it was ever really sustainable?
I think it's a great question because in mining, we talk about short summers and long winters. The previous cycle of high mining input cost inflation lasted for about 24 months. That was from November 2021 right up to February 2024. So we now had a low inflation environment in terms of input costs in mining for about 23 months. So it is our view that this might actually be one of the longest environment where we have had low mining cost in inflation.
To what extent is this being driven purely by the price of oil, perhaps versus broader disruptions within the global supply chain?
I think the first thing, maybe, Jeremy, that I need to take into your listeners into confidence is the fact that as a sector, we are price takers. The fact that when there are increases in input costs, we cannot transfer those increases into the price of the minerals and metals that we sell or that we produce. But I think also there within that, it's very important then to note that as price takers, our prices are determined by forces global forces of demand and supply. So the conflict, as it is certainly going to affect the operation or the profitability, in fact, of our members. Because if you look at the cost structure of mining in South Africa, is that the first one is labor cost, and labor costs about a quarter of our total input cost. It's followed by finance and insurance, which is about 10%, liquid fuels, and in this context, diesel and petrol, accounts for about 5.5% of our total input cost as mining. But it is our hope that with the ceasefire that kicked in today, that will be the end of the war. And if that's the case, what it means is that as mining, the only impact will be felt in April. Because on average, we spend about 3 billion rands a month on petrol and diesel. In April, we are going to spend about 4 billion rands this month in terms of petrol and diesel because of the price escalation.
And how quickly does that then hit the margins within the industry?
Like I'm saying, in April, this will start kicking in. There is no lag in mining. However, the lag would be in the context of what do we do in order to remain competitive. And here I'm talking about issues of employment. Do we continue hiring the number of people that we were currently hiring, which stands at about 472,000 people at the moment? And also, just to provide context with employment, in 2011, we employed 512,000 people. In 2025, we employed 472,000 people. So this is really, if it were to continue, the conflict in the Middle East and petrol and diesel prices remain at elevated levels, what it means is that to remain competitive, we'll have to see where we cut cost. But I must say, to answer your question directly, this hits us immediately as the cost increase, it hits us. But it's the adjustment period in terms of what do we do, which areas do we attend to basically mitigate the risk of costs.
That's also a not so subtle warning that the industry's got to brace itself for job losses.
Yeah, it is true. But like I said, Jeremy, earlier, that it is encouraging to hear that there's going to be a ceasefire. We just hope that this is basically the end of the war. But if the conflict continues, our competitiveness, global competitiveness, will certainly be at risk.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to build any kind of business on hope. What does all of this mean for investment decisions? Do companies delay expansion or do they start to cut back, and is there perhaps evidence of cutting back already?
Not necessarily. There's no evidence of cutting back already, but I was just talking about the fact that the impact is immediate. You see, the higher mining cost means that a bigger portion of our revenue, the revenue that we generate, will now go into covering our costs, the cost increases that we are talking about. This is revenue that we could have actually used as capital to expand our business, and now we are using it to basically pay more in terms of those input costs. It might mean as well that in the long term, if it continues, jobs will be compromised so that we remain competitive. Again, let me remind your listeners that in 1994, we employed over 600,000 people. Last year, it was just over 470,000 people. And one of the reasons for the decline in employment is because of cost pressures. But the consequence, in fact, has not only been the reduction in employment. We have also seen the sector itself contracting. In 2025, the mining sector, in real terms, was 84% of what it was in 1994. The sector is the only sector, in fact, that has been shrinking compared to the other nine macroeconomic sectors.
Just a final question. We reference labor and also fuel, but electricity is also a big cost driver, and that surely is already compounding an already fragile cost base.
Yeah, earlier, Jeremy, when I said that, among other things, the reason for the decline in employment and also the contraction, the decline in the sector contracting in real terms, I said it's cost pressures. And foremost on those pressures, it's labor costs. But also in there, you have electricity. Mm. Our electricity since 2007 has increased by almost 1,000%. So it has significantly compromised our global competitiveness. So electricity is an issue. I mean, starting when 1st of April, electricity grew by almost 9% compared to the previous year. So that does compromise our global competitiveness.
It is a very worrying picture indeed. Bongani Motsa, thank you very much indeed. Chief Economist at the Minerals Council, South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africans are increasingly dipping into their retirement savings just to stay afloat, with billions of rand being withdrawn as financial pressure continues to mount. And what was meant to secure long-term stability is now being used as a short-term survival tool. It's worrying. It's raising serious concerns about whether the system itself is working or whether households are simply running out of options. Well, someone who has a view on that is Vicky Langer, who's head of solutions enhancement at Alex Forbes. Vicky, a very warm welcome to you, and let's call it what it is. Are South Africans effectively liquidating their retirement just to get through the month? Is it as bad as that?
Hi, Jeremy. So unfortunately, the stats are a bit concerning. But ultimately, I think the two-pot system is doing what it intended to do. If we recall, it was, it did come up as a concept through the COVID years when that extreme financial distress was out there and happening. But ultimately, yes, based on surveys we've done, 80% of members using their savings pot withdrawals to cover their debt and essential living expenses. So definitely the majority of members using this money trying to get through, day to day in terms of the financial pressure that they're under.
And therein lies the problem, because initially, as I understand it, the two-pot system was sold as a safety valve. But what I'm hearing you say is it's now opened the floodgates with very serious consequences.
Sure. So, look, to give some context, the two-pot regime is still much better than the previous regime in the sense that it aims to solve the longer-term preservation requirements. So, recall under the old regime, on changing jobs, members could take literally all their retirement savings out in cash, and unfortunately, most did do that. What's happened since the two-pot system has been introduced, two-thirds of contributions are going towards the retirement pot and have to remain invested until the point of retirement and then annuitized to buy a pension. So the two-pot system is still projected to give 2 to 2.5 times better retirement outcomes than the old regime. But yes, your point's taken in the sense that, the retirement fund is there as a last option resort, not supposed to be a first option when needing cash in a bit of an emergency. So in other words, to put it a bit differently, only under extreme emergency situations should one be looking at taking money out of the retirement fund. First, look at other options out there. If, of course, there's nothing, then the retirement fund does stand in as an option for most households.
Let me pick you up on that phrase, extreme emergency, if I can. You sit, Vicky, close to the data. Are a significant number of people using the money as intended, or is it now also being used just for discretionary spending?
So that is an excellent question, and unfortunately, we don't have full insight through to exactly where, the expense goes through to. All we have at our disposal is just based on the survey results around, as I mentioned, 80% of members that we have withdrawn using it to cover debt, essential living expenses. There's nothing that's come up through the data that we have access to indicate, otherwise. But it is concerning that it's this many members needing to dip in on a frequent basis. So to just give a statistic, 31% of the members claiming in the 2025 tax year have had to claim again and again. So in other words, up to 3 times from their retirement funds. So that may indicate that perhaps, maybe members are not considering other options before the retirement fund, and maybe it's become a little bit too easy to get access from the retirement savings, because there's no vetting that's done around financial distress. So it's based on a trust, a system of trust, if I can put it that way.
So if it's too easy, then, as you're suggesting, do you think it's fair to say that funds and administrators are maybe quietly worried that this is becoming a structural drain now on long-term savings?
So, as I mentioned, from a structural perspective, we're very confident that the two-pot regime will ultimately deliver better long-term outcomes from a retirement savings perspective because of the fact that two-thirds of contributions will remain invested all the way through to retirement. So members aren't able to access that. They're only able to access, the one-third of contributions that's going into the savings pot. So structurally, the two-pot system still significantly better than the old regime. I guess into the future, we need to think, can further enhancements be made to the system?
And therein lies the problem, potentially. We might be heading towards a generation that simply won't be able to retire.
So the reason the two-pot system exists is because, previously the statistics are, and currently still is, around 6% of South Africans, in a position to afford retirement. And the two-pot regime aims to improve that statistic. But it will happen gradually over time because, you know, there would have been a lot of retirement savings in the system already, and that's actually all sitting in what's referred to as the vested pot. So the old regime and the old rules still apply to that. So yeah, so we're still going to probably see, you know, let's call it poor retirement outcomes for a while until the two-pot system has been in place for long enough so that one can actually see that improvement come through over time. But yes, I do think that with the new system, it's probably prudent to leave it to do what it's expected to do, but at some point sort of reevaluating to see if further enhancement or improvement can be made.
So too early then for government maybe to step in and tighten access, even if that were to cause short-term pain?
Yes, I think it's probably a bit too premature as, you know, as we sit here today. It's what, about 1.5 or so years into the two-pot system. So it's still early days for the new system. And I think we can give it time. Having said that, I think it's very unlikely that there would be a significant change in member behavior in terms of what we've seen so far. I hope I'm wrong, but so far I think, you know, this pattern of or trend of repeat withdrawals from the savings pot, I think, is likely to continue rather than to not continue into the future.
Vicky Langer, thank you very much indeed. Head of Solutions Enhancement at Alex Forbes.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, rising oil prices are no longer just a fuel story, I would contend. They're fast becoming a housing story as well, threatening affordability, delaying rate relief, and putting fresh pressure on a property market that had only just started to recover. Someone with a view on that is Professor Simphiwe Madikizela, adjunct academic in economics at the University of South Africa. Professor, a very warm welcome, and let's wade straight in. Let's start with the economics. How direct is the link between rising oil prices and housing affordability?
Thank you so much, Jeremy. So it's got a very direct impact, and this is how it works. So we'll remember that because of the war that we have in Middle East, and we thank God that at the moment there's a ceasefire, which is just only temporary and only 2 weeks, and we hope it sustained this longer. But we'll probably talk more about that later on. So there is a direct impact in the sense that as South Africa were importing oil, we were very much dependent in terms of the imports for oil. Now, the crude oil prices have risen up because of the war. Now, that translates into petrol prices, as we've seen the increase now last week of this month in April. And that increase in petrol prices results in transportation costs increasing. I think that's a known story. And also the food prices also going up over a period of time. These are not immediate, because we remember that the diesel we use in the farms to produce, the trucks use the diesel to transport. So the transportation, logistics and food prices direct link there. But the same applies with housing as well, because when the petrol price has gone up, when inflation goes up, because inflation is a general increase in prices, right? So once inflation goes up, then affordability becomes a challenge, because we've got a National Credit Act that requires of the banks to do affordability assessment when a person applies for a house. Even those who've got houses, they'll pay more. But more important, for those who still want to buy houses for the first time, they'll find it difficult to qualify because this puts pressure. Why does it put pressure? Increased inflation results in increased interest rates. Once interest rates increase, which we're not there yet, but that's a risk. That's why we're giving a warning that if this war persists for a long time, inflation will be under pressure. Central banks will be forced to increase the rates, interest rates, to try and protect the inflation and keep it down. As we know, that SARB is using the inflation targeting tool, which is around 3% now at the moment.
So there's a ripple effect right through the entire economy, and that feeds quickly, fairly quickly, into the property market, doesn't it?
Definitely it does. And remember, when you talk about property, it's not just buying the house only. Even developers build houses, they will also be feeling the pressure as well. Construction as well, property prices will be affected. So it goes through the whole economy. Even electricity prices, we've seen that they've gone up as well. So even maintenance of the existing houses for those who've got houses becomes high. So it affects the household expenditure, household budget. It becomes under pressure. All of a sudden, your net disposable income becomes less, because when the interest rates go up, even the repayment amounts will go up for those who own properties. They will pay more. And this is across cars, vehicles as well, not houses only. Any credit that you have, you will pay more once the interest rates go up. So it's got a direct impact and the pressure. And this is quite real. And people will feel already our consumers are under pressure as we speak anyway, even before the war took place. Yes.
Let me ask you a question about impact and consequence then. And I would assume that lower to middle income buyers are the most exposed, particularly in the more price sensitive end of the market.
Very much so. And if we look at the stats and the data, it will tell us between 20 to 40% of the income in the lower income segment up to middle, they use it on transportation costs, transport costs, traveling and all of that. It puts pressure already. So it becomes a reality for them. And the poor and the lower income to middle will feel the pinch even much more. Even the high income and earning customers will still feel the pinch, but they do have a bit of options, because you find that some of them, they already own more than one property. Some of the properties are for investment, they are renting them out. But for the lower income to middle, you find that some of them will be the first time owners and buyers of property. So they might be paying a rent at the moment. They've got a wish of buying their own property. So then qualifying will become a challenge for them. So they will feel the pinch even more, and the pressure even more, the lower to middle income household, very much so.
And this then means that we could start seeing a reshaping of where people choose to live, with commuting costs, as you pointed out, pushing demand closer to work and transport nodes. But again, there's always that issue of affordability, isn't there?
Most definitely. So most people will tend to buy closer to where they work, so that they limit the time of traveling and the costs involved. In fact, the National Development Plan, NDP Vision 2030, if you look at Chapter 8 of it, it talks to transforming human settlements. So it is a plan that people are resettled closer to cities, places of work, so that they don't travel more. But land is more expensive there. The prime land is expensive in the cities. So even the cost of building also go up for developers as well. So meaning that the prices will be high, which talks to affordability for them to be able to get in, to qualify. As much as there's a subsidy that government has for first-time buyers up to 22,000 income, the first home finance subsidy, which was called FLIS before, it's available. But even that in itself is not sufficient. It doesn't solve the problem of affordability, but it does come a long way to help.
So, Professor, at what point then does this stop becoming a temporary oil shock and rather a broader property market problem?
It will become that if this war persists for a long period of time, like now there's a ceasefire, as you probably know, just for 2 weeks. Even that is debatable, because we had now in the news as well that there were strikes to Lebanon. They thought Lebanon is included in this ceasefire, but it's not. 250 people more have died. Hundreds of people have been injured as well. So this, the market, if you look at the way the market is responding, even this so-called ceasefire for 2 weeks is actually not secured, because look at how the price is doing for crude oil. It's gone up again now, close to 100. It went down to 93. It moved up to 96, 97, thereabout now, because the market is responding to that, right? To say, look, it's not secured. 2 weeks is too short. Even that is not sustainable. They're not sure if it's going to be honored as well. So we need the war to come to an end. That's what we hope for. Once the war comes to an end, at least then we can go back to normality. But if this war does not come to an end anytime close, and is perpetuated, is elongated, and is drawn out, then this is going to become a reality for us in the not-so-distant future, in the couple of months which will be coming.
And just a quick reply, there's a real risk here of stagflation as well. Slower growth, sticky inflation, and as you've referenced, a weaker housing recovery, all happening at the same time.
Most definitely. And it's so unfortunate for us as South Africa, because we were on a good wicket. I mean, we've just been out of the grey listing. We had seen the endorsement by the rating agencies. We've seen the inflation being the lowest at 3.5 in 21 years. And we've seen the unemployment starting to come down a little bit in 5 years. So we're really on a good trajectory. The budget speech was good, well received by the market. Business confidence was there and so on. But then the war happened, right? And everything just changed for the worse, unfortunately for us.
Professor Simpiwe Madikizela, thank you very much indeed, from the University of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As fuel prices climb on the back of Middle East tensions, the ripple effects are starting, I think, to reshape how companies think about office space, with long commutes becoming more expensive and less sustainable for employees. And I think there's a growing shift towards smaller, decentralized offices closer to where people live, and a renewed focus on buildings near transport routes as businesses look to cut costs and retain staff. Let's discuss that in a little more detail with Scott Thorburn, asset manager at Redefine Properties. So rising fuel costs are a reality in our lives. This is now becoming a real driver, I imagine, of office strategy, not just short-term pressure.
Yes, Jeremy. Look, I think it's always been in companies' agenda to make sure they're near transport hubs. That hasn't changed. However, I think the ripple effect of the high fuel price would be a bigger threat to offices and commercial property in general. We need GDP growth and all those type of things don't help for that. We've always had our strategy of having offices and all properties around transport hubs and networks because companies have always wanted this. So I don't think it changes anything. It's not really a structural shift as there was with COVID. But I think that the pressures are that allows weighting of these aspects weighs heavily on companies' decisions.
But Scott, you'll agree that pressure is starting to increase fairly dramatically. I would imagine you're either seeing or will see tenants in greater numbers shift towards buildings that are closer to these transport nodes.
100%. All our buildings around car train stations are already fully let. I think a lot of companies will also do the hub and spoke scenario where they have a central office and then offices or flexible workspace, shared workspace closer to homes and areas of where people live. We've actually had a lot of, in Bryanston, for instance, Greenstone, our properties have actually, the vacancies have dropped significantly on the back of this.
So what do you think this means for longer term patterns in terms of growth and letting? Are we starting to see something fundamentally changing? And that obviously is going to have an impact on rental.
Yes, so your rentals around these nodes will definitely be more solid, vacancies lower. But again, Jeremy, it hasn't changed. The old location still stands, probably more so now, but it still stands. You've got to be in the right place with amenities, and actually qualities come into that in a big way as well.
I'm interested in this hub and spoke model that you referred to. What does it look like in practice for South African companies? And is it something that is just serving staff? Or in your experience, Scott, does it really work for an organization?
I think it does depend on the type of business, but we are seeing it more and more often where maybe they have the head office in, say, Sandton or Rosebank, but they would have staff working maybe on a hybrid system at home, but also going into sort of hub offices, be it in Bryanston, Midrand, closer to home, so their costs and time spent in traffic is less. So we're seeing more and more of that, and it makes a lot of sense. And then they would maybe meet once or twice a week, the actual hub, if required.
How much of the shift do you think is about real cost and bottom line to the company versus employee well-being and retention?
Definitely retention, well-being, and attracting staff. We recently did a poll on LinkedIn where we got 56% of the respondents said that they preferred hybrid workspace or hybrid work model. So that's really, I think that's changed over time. Before, it may be a lot more working from home, but I think after COVID, people realize that collaboration, contact with people, is key for well-being as well as for the company themselves.
So that's interesting. That intersection with the return to office debate is, if I'm hearing you correctly, over. We've kind of moved beyond that phase now, that there's not the urgency to have your 2 or 3 days at home as there was maybe even a year, 18 months ago.
Yes, Jeremy, I think it's settled. We've had that structural shift. Companies have worked very hard to get their staff back willingly and happily. So even if the fuel cost did carry on for a while, there may be a subsidy that they would look at rather than allowing people to go back to the to work from home.
Scott, I'm interested in your comments around, particularly in Johannesburg, around the Gautrain station. Do you think, or you've suggested to me, that well-located buildings are now commanding a premium? Obviously, I understand that. What does that mean for more isolated office parks, of which there are in abundance? Is that concept, do you think, becoming obsolete?
No, almost the reverse. We've seen an uptick in certain nodes. I wouldn't say all of them. So we're closer to residential areas, quite high density areas. We've seen our vacancies drop. For example, Greenstone, not just our office parks, there's very little space available in offices, believe it or not. Midrand likewise, and Bryanston's improving greatly. So I think also the smaller companies would be in those types of areas generally, or the branches or the spokes, as we talked about earlier. So there's definitely a demand for that for smaller companies. The CEO may work in the area. And they've all those areas also got a very good transport network, not just for Gautrain.
And just finally then, from an investment perspective, does this change what the concept of prime property actually means in South Africa? Has the definition changed, or is it changing?
I would say it's pretty much the same. Investment strategies have always been on location, which demand good transport amenities, quality of property. So just further cements, I think, definitely what we've been looking at.
Scott Thorburn, I'm going to leave it there. Asset Manager, Redefine Properties. I appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is our program for today and, in fact, for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.